Well, welcome. Again, my name is John Dyer. That's my little website there, j.hn. And this is my family. So I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old. That's them when they're a little bit younger on the left when we were living in Durham, England for a little while. So I'm doing some PhD work there. And then that's us on the beach just a couple weeks ago for spring break. So they are great little guys in kindergarten and second grade. And I work down at Dallas Theological Seminary. So I do a lot of their communications and marketing and software development. And we like to take a lot of the things that we do there and open source them for the internet to use. And so the video player technology that we've developed there at DTS now runs about a quarter of the internet on terms of the way the video works. That's really, really fun to be, you know, part of just the world of technology and developing it, and not just kind of talking about it, but actually getting to do it. I also get to work on some Bible software, which is kind of neat. Not that it does anything special that other Bible software doesn't do, other than that it's meant to be put on ships and smuggled into closed countries. So this is software that we use in North Korea and Iran and stuff like that, where there's dictators and bad people. So it's a fun deal to be a part of taking the gospel out into the world and doing that. I will admit to you guys, though, the first launch of this a couple years back, I got the email on my phone that it launched, and I went into the restroom, kind of like there would be one down the hall, and there was somebody behind me that kept kind of looking at me. You know how somebody's looking over your shoulder at your phone? I just trying to ignore them because I thought it was weird. So I put my phone back out and I exited the restroom, and then I saw a man walking into the women's restroom, and I thought, man, I should stop this guy. So I went to go stop him, and then I realized he was going into the men's room. Some of you are fast, man. Which meant that I had been coming out of the women's restroom. And so the person staring over my shoulder was not a weird person. It was a poor, poor, poor woman who realized that I had been staring at my phone as I walked right into the women's restroom. So you can be doing, you know, really neat things for the kingdom of God and still goof up with these things. I also like to make fun Bible websites, so I made this one called Y'all Version. And if you don't know, in English, we don't have what's called a second person plural. We just say you to refer to everybody. So we corrected this wherever in Greek it says you and it's supposed to be plural, it inserts that. So you can go to Y'all Version and you can look up the Bible as it was meant to be read in Texan. And if you're from another area, you can change it to you guys if you're from Chicago, stuff like that. I also like to play around with artificial intelligence, so I dumped in a bunch of popular worship music and had it try to write worship music for me, and this is what it came up with. Might be something you'd hear on the radio someday. Anyway, so I obviously have always enjoyed playing with technology. This is me as a kid. Just kidding. That's not really me. This is just a little animated loop that I like. But I really do enjoy playing with these things. And yet I realize that in parenting today that technology can be kind of a scary thing. So that's what we're going to talk about a little bit. But imagine this. Imagine you overheard two teenagers talking. And you heard them, and one of them said something like, "My parents never really talked to me about it. I learned everything I knew from school and talking with other kids. I mean, I know my parents know all about it, and I know they do it, but it's so gross to think about them doing it, and they're always doing it wrong. But I also know I've done some things that I regret, and I just wish they would have talked to me about it." What do you think they would be talking about normally? Yeah, right. So it seems like technology is kind of the new sex thing that we need to talk with our kids about, right? Sex is this ongoing conversation that we talk with them about at every age, and we help them understand their own bodies as they grow up and what's going to change with them and how that's related and what God wants of them. And I think now technology is that thing that we need to talk with our kids constantly about. It's not something that we can do one and done. There is no app that I can tell you that will solve all of your problems. What I'm going to do today is give you just some things that may equip you to be able to have ongoing conversations with your kids. We'll give lots of resources that you can look up that have step-by-step guides. We're not going to try to go through every single thing like that today, just because it wouldn't be all that useful. You really need to be in front of your devices to do that. But we will go through some things. So if you're anything like me, it seemed like there was this time when everything was beautiful and good, and then these things that we love come along, and they have sort of distracted us and made us busy. And if you ask the average parent, do you think parenting is harder today than it was, say, 40 years ago? Would you guys say yes or no? Yes, right? So yes, most parents would say yes, and you may not be able to read all of this, but if you ask them what is it is that worries them, there are things like religious diversity. Your kids are around a lot of different kinds of people than maybe you were around, or bullying at school. These are all big, important things. But the number one thing that most parents are worried about is technology and social media across the board. They are worried that the world is more dangerous and some of those things and morality, but technology is the number one thing that we are all sort of collectively worried about. And believe it or not, people in Silicon Valley are worried about this as well. Did you know this? Did you know that the guy that invented the iPad doesn't allow iPads at home? Evan Williams is the founder, you can see on here, of Twitter and Medium. He also does not allow iPads at home and makes sure that he has lots and lots of books for his young kids, who are, I think, under 10 at this point. So this is a great New York Times article on both of these guys. You also see that a lot of people over in the Silicon Valley area, they will send their kids to sort of tech-free type schools where they can learn about a lot, kind of in a classical education style model where they're able to learn and memorize and do those things that ultimately, I think, can help you be a better technologist down the road, but that they're not constantly looking at devices all day at school. So these are kind of interesting counterintuitive things. As much as these are the folks that sell us technology, they also recognize that there needs to be some limitations on there in order to make somebody actually be very good and performant at it. So what I want to do is just talk a little bit about some of the challenges and complexities we see today. This first one's kind of sad. You may have seen this in the news that a church from San Antonio, that a truck hit a bus from a church and killed 13 people, and this was a guy who was texting. And normally, I wouldn't want to show something like this just because I'm not real into scare stories. I mean, there's lots of those out there. You can watch the news, and you always find scary things. I don't really want to argue from scary stories. Other than that, if you kind of go from like the 1950s and you look at how many wrecks there were, it's been steadily dropping for the last 60 years. Cars get safer with airbags, anti-lock brakes. I'm sure probably about 60 to 70% of you, your anti-lock brakes kicked in today, and you had no idea. Right? It's just artificial intelligence built into your car that probably saved your life just this morning. So things are getting safer and safer. But for the last about 3 years, it's been the first time in about the last 60 years where the accidents are starting to go back up again with pedestrians and all kinds of people. And we pretty much think it's because of distracted drivers. And it's mostly us as adults who just got to do that one text. It's just real quick. We just have to do it real fast. But we're all doing it, right? Even if we don't want to admit it. So a lot of us are doing this. And then probably the other number one thing that we see is that pornography is something that our kids are definitely going to see at a certain point. So this is not a question of if they see it before they leave our house. It's a question of when they see it and have we prepared them to interact with it? Have we prepared them to shut it down and to come and talk to us? So this is an absolute certainty that your children will see things that you didn't see. Or if you saw them when you were a kid, they will see things 10 times worse than what you saw. Right? So this is not just pictures of naked people. This is pictures of naked people doing things that they will see pretty quickly. It says, you see these various stats about something like a third of internet traffic is devoted to pornography, and that most people are seeing this at a pretty early age, sometimes as young as 6. So you might think that your kid isn't going to see that, but that some friend of a friend is going to see something and show somebody. So if kids are ever together or if we're not being careful about who's using what devices when. And so there's these, you know, terrible things called slut pages at every high school. So lots and lots of dark stuff out there. This is a silly illustration for our last political election, actually. Just kidding. This is, you know, we're all also worried about our kids and cyberbullying, but I don't think that what we're seeing, especially in the last few months, has been particularly a good guide for us, right? What we saw in the last few months in terms of the way that people interacted online and the kinds of things that we sometimes said to one another about someone's candidate or not, and sometimes what the candidates themselves said. We're also worried about, you know, someone kind of stalking our kids. This is a particularly disturbing thing that I saw when I was in England. It was a little PSA about the dangers of predators out there. At the same time, this is all the scary stuff, right? At the same time, technology has this beautiful way of making the world better, you know? It's a little girl getting a custom 3D printed arm, and she'll be able to get upgrades over time. And isn't that amazing, you know, to see? This is a little boy who's hearing his dad for the very first time with a cochlear implant. It's pretty amazing. And you think, you know when John the Baptist was kind of getting discouraged and he called up Jesus and he said, "Hey, are you really the Messiah?" Do you remember what Jesus' answer was? He said, "The blind are receiving sight and the deaf are receiving hearing and the lame are walking." This was his sign for who he was. And yet technology is allowing us to do this today. And I think this is pretty glorious. It's also, you know, changing light bulbs for us, which is just kind of fun. So there's a lot of neat stuff, and I think God's given us this creativity, and it's a lot of fun. So we would need to be able to appreciate and enjoy these things. At the same time, there's a lot of things about technology that aren't as intuitive as we might think. So, you know, one of the common things you hear today is, you know, kids are always looking at their phones, that they're not able to look at each other, they're not able to interact, right? This is a conversation that we all have with each other. But it's not as if people have ever not used media to separate themselves, right? So this is somewhat of an old problem. Remember in some of Solomon's writing in Kohelet, it says, of the making of books, there's no end, right? That was 3,500 years ago. And you start seeing people talking about information overload post-printing press. And you start seeing people talking about nobody ever writes letters anymore back in the 1850s and these kinds of things with the telegraph. So people have been, you know, complaining about technology for a while. It always feels like it's moving faster and faster and faster. And in fact, most of us, if we think about what technology actually is, if we think about a definition for it, probably the best definition for technology is anything invented after you were born, right? Because everything before you were born is just stuff. That's the way that the world works. So cars and air conditioning and lighting, all that stuff is just how things go. But then everything from 0 to 35 is the cool, amazing stuff you can build your career on. And then everything after 35 is the destruction of society and the degradation of our children's minds, right? That's how we all are. So depending on when you were born, TV might be normal and telephones might be normal, but say social media might not be. But if you were born in the last 10 years, so you've never known a world without social media. And my own kids find this computer, which was like $3,000, to be kind of broken because the screen, you can't touch it. Right? Because they've grown up with screen things. That's normal to be able to touch. So we all have this. And if you ask kids, would you prefer to be face-to-face or would you prefer to be online? What do you think they say now? Online. That's what you'd think, right? But kids would actually say that they prefer to be face-to-face. But when you ask, what percentage do you do, more online or more face-to-face, what do you think happens? More online. Now, why do you think that is?
Easier
24 hours. Yeah. What else? What's that?
Busy
schedules. You're right. You're getting at some things that are things people don't normally think about. Anything else?
Maybe less threatening,
yeah. So in Dana Boyd's book, It's Complicated, she's a researcher at Columbia and at Microsoft. What she came up with was yes, kids would prefer to be face-to-face, but they don't spend that much time. And she devoted it to two reasons. One of these is overscheduled, so kids are having to do all kinds of things in high school to get into college, and they got to be in all these different clubs, all these different things. And the other one is that their parents are deeply, deeply worried that the world is scarier than it used to be. And so they don't allow their kids to go out and have unstructured play. Now, if you've ever looked at statistics on murder, on theft, on rape, on any of those things, they are down about four times from 1990. Right, so the most violent year in American history was 1980, and it has gone down since then. So we're about four times safer than it was when we were kids. Does that seem true?
No.
No, why not?
Because you see it more.
Yeah, because we watch 24-hour news, right? So 24-hour news was also invented in 1980. So all of us have been programmed for fear. We are programmed to believe that the world is a terrible, evil, scary place, when statistically it's not, right? So what happens is we force our kids to stay at home, and we overschedule them, and then the only way for them to image the triune God is to go online. So some of this is more complicated than we think. And so there's these articles like The Atlantic about the overprotected kid. Now, that kind of puts some onus on us. At the same time, there are a lot of scary things out there. There's a lot of apps that are really designed to be hidden, to not be public. You may have seen some of these and maybe haven't seen others of them. So these are some real significant worries that we have, that we don't always sure which apps are okay and which apps aren't. Some of these, like Yik Yak, are around for a while, and that one has already kind of faded away. But there's also some other counterintuitive things, like this one, about who's more willing to get their phone out during a meal. And so our kids are watching us, right? They're watching what we do, and then what we say, and they're wondering, is there a disconnect here between what we say is okay and are we think of ourselves as being special? At the same time, there is just some new confusion in the world, right? When a kid sees you with your machine, it's not entirely certain what's going on, right? It's all the same thing. Now, so this is a new kind of reality of convergence on everything. So we do our taxes on our computer. oh, I got to do my taxes. We do all kinds of things on these, all on the same device. And it's very hard for a kid to really start to understand the differences between work and play and leisure and relationship, because they're all done on the same device. And this is a new challenge for us. So I find a lot of times I have to kind of narrate with my own kids, like, well, I'm working on a talk for a church I'm going to go to the next morning, or I'm doing something for my other job, or whatever it is that I need to talk them through that, because they can't really recognize what's going on. When they use the computer, it's oftentimes for fun, and so we talk about that a lot. And then all of us across the board are probably more worried about losing our phone than we are about losing our keys, right? This is where most of our life is, and so something about 2/3 of people would really, really freak out if you had your phone. Do you guys all have your phone? Just feel it in your pocket. Just make sure it's there. Okay, everybody's okay. Just cross yourself and know your phone. You're good. So things are complicated today. And if we think about what are we going to do for parenting? So in the age of parenting, we look at our little babies and we think, what do we really want them to be when they grow up? What's our goal? And I used to be a youth pastor, and I know parents wouldn't say it this way directly, but when I was a youth pastor, sometimes I felt like this is what they wanted. Right? What they wanted was to make sure their kids weren't into alcohol and hadn't had sex yet. And if that happened, they felt like they had succeeded, you know? 18 sex-free years, and then they can go off and, you know, that's it. I think, you know, I know nobody would ever say that, but sometimes that's the way that we treat it, is as long as we can prevent these two things. And that's true. I mean, we do really want to prevent people from dishonoring God in this way, or dishonoring their own bodies or their future spouses. At the same time, I like to use this word virtuous citizens, in part because if I'm with an audience of people who aren't believers, this is language that works. Even though virtue is originally a Christian term, we in our kind of Bible church, community church movement, we don't usually use that term. And we often think of ourselves primarily as Christians, which is good, but we also want to think of ourselves as participants in a broader society. So if we think about, Jeremiah 29:11, our favorite verse about, I know the plans I have for you, a little bit later in that verse, God would say that, while you're in exile, which we all kind of are to a certain degree, that we want to be there for the benefit of the city. And so we want to be able to create little men and women who are Christ followers, but also that have not just things that they don't do, a series of things that you've told them not to do, but also a set of virtues that they can go forward with and things that they can offer into a world that's hurting and needs them. So what we want to do is this. We want to have some goals that go beyond just preventing bad things from happening. We certainly want to do that, and we're going to get there. But developing character and virtue and finding places to do that is our number one goal. And then I think our other one is to figure out, how do we help our own kids become their own best filter? Because we can install all the filters we want on our devices, and those are good, and I think that we should do those things. But ultimately, we want to teach our kids to be their own best filter. Right? Because we can all get around filters, right? We're all smart, and our kids are smarter than us, and they can get around them too. So we want them to be there to protect them when they're young, but ultimately to help them be their own best decision makers, and to do this by the power of the Spirit and through the salvation offered in Jesus. So for us, the way that we're going to do that is we're going to have some protection and limiting that we're going to do for our kids, and we'll talk about some details on this later. And as they get older, then we're going to be doing some things that we could call training, we could call it mentoring, we could also call it modeling, all this stuff where we are developing a relationship with them that isn't just about installing and limiting things. So there's some things that I think we need to do with devices. That's method number one. But the rest of this is going to be all relational in there. So if you think about some things, we'll talk about virtue just for a minute here. There's the bad ones, right? There's the seven deadly sins plus American consumerism that we all want our kids to avoid. But if you think about the things that we want out of our kids, if we want to have them be able to have their energy directed toward other people, like generosity, or if we want them to be able to have to take time before they judge something. It's not that we don't want them to judge things, but we want them to take time and have patience. We want people to be able to live in the present, right? To be able to live satisfied in the present with contentment. If we want to think accurately about ourselves and other people, that's humility. It's not thinking of ourselves less. It's just thinking less about ourselves, right? And thinking accurately about it. And then being able to focus on important things. This is diligence. Creativity, finding beauty whenever there's boredom. Do you think modern technology contributes or takes away from these things? It can be challenging, right? some of these virtues that we want them to have. So, of course, we do want to protect them from lust and gluttony and all of these things. But if we want someone to be generous, to be self-directed, it's hard to do that when we're thinking about ourselves and what we post all the time. If we want to be able to focus deeply on something, that's hard to do if we're constantly having, you know, screens on in the background and TV and radio and all those things. And it's, again, hard to think about yourself accurately if we're always rating people in some way and liking them, those kinds of things. And when social media always wants us to jump to judgment and to say things really fast, tweet at 5 a.m. in the morning when we're mad at something, that is something that doesn't help us to have a lot of patience. So I think that a lot of the things that we want to develop are being challenged by technology. And as much as we say that older technology has been shaping us for a long time, I do think our newer ones do. But if we think about how to launch adults, just basically, this is just kind of parenting 101, as our kids get older and older and older, what we want to be able to do is to give them more and more responsibility over time, right? And we think about our goal is to have these adults that can make choices. I think of when my kids are really little and I think about brushing teeth. Now, when a kid's 2 years old, do you want to brush their teeth or do you want to just let them do it, give them the responsibility? Which one? Right? So you could just say, I'm just going to do it, which is probably important when someone's two. Or you could say, I'll just let them do it. But in reality, we're going to take this kind of path upward, where early on, we're going to do a lot of things for them. We're going to try to protect their health with their teeth, and we're going to show them how to do it and walk them through it. And eventually, we're going to let them do it. And you know, kids do it terribly at first, you know, but you have to let them fail. You have to let them fail repeatedly over and over again and continue to guide and instruct and be patient. And over time, they get better and better at this thing so that you're able to launch a kid who at least brushes once or twice a week, right? That's the goal at the end of the day, at least if they remember. I think that's maybe flossing. But anyway, but we have to do it for them early on and then give them more and more responsibility. And this is the way it is with everything, right? You get a driver's permit at one age, and then later on, you finally get the license. So there's a period where we do training and guidance and oversight before we hand them the final keys. And maybe, you know, you have a bedtime, and later on, that bedtime gets later and later. These are the moves upward toward this, and we may have to adjust depending on how the kid responds. So our goal, again, isn't just to do one thing, one time, one conversation, but it's this ongoing development of giving more and more responsibility with the hope that we're going to launch these adults who can make great choices at the end. So somewhere in here, we've got these kind of decisions, right? How do we do this in a way where we're able to give some responsibility but also guard and give more responsibility and do feedback through a loop? That's what we want to be able to get to. But I want to remind us of something. If we think back to Native American history, and we think about a kid maybe turning 12 or 13 and maybe becoming a man, usually in most cultures, there's some kind of physical object, some thing, some tool that people get when they become of some kind of age. So if that's a bow and arrow or a spear or whatever it is, or a plow, something like that. But this usually is determined by age, maturity, and training, right? All three of those things are things that people would do before they give somebody a bow and arrow. And, you know, starting in maybe the 1940s through the 80s or something like that, the car was the thing like this. This is what represented independence and freedom and adulthood. This is what we would give our kids. But we would make them go through a lot of training. They'd have to be at a certain age, and they would have to demonstrate dependability before you would give them a full-on car. But today, the temptation for parents is to hand someone a device that's far more powerful than a bow and arrow and far more powerful than a car, but give it to them when they're two with no training, right? This is the default that every commercial tells us that we ought to do. And yet we've never done this in human history. So for us, I think we're going to need to have some of this training. And I think we just want to remember that both two things, that our kids are going to whine and complain. That's just part of it. They're going to say no. They're going to want more. They're always going to push and push and push. But we're the parents. We're the ones who are responsible for it. And I think, you know, when the kid turns 18 and heads off, you can't do anything about it then. So if your kid's 15 and going nuts now, it's a time to pull it back in and just eat it. Have them not like you for a little while. But I think that they'll appreciate you in the end. But also to recognize everyone's going to fail. You're going to fail. They're going to fail. And having that ongoing relationship, the grace that Jesus gives us is the same that we want to extend to our kids. I want to put this up. These are a couple of great resources, which I'll come back to at the end. But if you're interested, these are the kind of websites out there that have great step-by-step guides about how to secure your phone, if it's an Apple phone or an Android phone. And again, we'll give you all this stuff. Specific advice on how to talk your kids through pornography at the Protect Young Minds. There's a great app guide. So we can't go through every app here. And even if we did, a new one would come out tomorrow. So these are just guidances that I want you to be regularly thinking about how to go to. But for us, what we're going to do is go a little bit deeper. I mean, this is Stonebriar, right? This is, you guys like to go deep. So we're going to try to go a little bit deeper into some ideas about technology here. But I think what we want our kids to be able to do, I love this statement by Jesus that he wants us to be as wise as a snake, but as innocent as a dove. And if we can give our kids that gift to help them to be wise, excuse me, but to retain their innocence, and to recognize that we have to be vigilant on this, and to recognize that there is someone who's looking to devour our kids. And so we have to be active on this, and there isn't one simple app. But the good news is this. Here's the first one. Believe it or not, technology is good in the biblical story. Have any of you guys think of a verse that references technology? When Jesus said, come follow me, he wasn't talking about Twitter, but, you know, what else? Can you think about references? There's not a lot, right? The Bible doesn't talk about phones and those kinds of things. But I think in the story of God, you'll see that God cares deeply about creativity and human creativity as part of the story of God. And we could do a lot on this, but when I think back to the very first thing when we were introduced to God, in the beginning, God created, right? That's the first thing we see about him. And whatever the image of God means, it's all kinds of things. Theologians have spilled all kinds of ink and broken lots of keyboards talking about what the image of God means. But I think part of it is our own sense of creativity that God created. And when we look in the garden, in Genesis 2, we'll see that Adam is there, and God says, or Adam isn't there yet. God says, there's no shrubs here yet. And the reason is there's no rain, and there's no human being to make something out of the ground, to do something out of it. And so his original command to us is to cultivate and to keep. That word cultivate is the word that we get our own word culture from. And it also means kind of tool using. So the idea is that God is kind of like dumping out a box of Legos on the ground and saying, make something cool with this. That's what he's saying about the world. So he wants us to make art and beauty, to find rare metals down in the ground and those things that go into our computers. I think God cares about seeing what we're going to create with it. And Adam and Eve, of course, they don't create anything physical in the story that we get. But God does ask Adam to create language there. So he's creating names. And language is one of the most powerful tools we have for shaping what we see and what we don't see about the world. So if you've ever read someone's text that you didn't understand, you recognize how language can separate or join together two cultures, right? If you've ever been called anti-woman or anti-health when you were pro-life, you understand the power of language and labels, right? If you have wondered about the difference between being a homemaker or a stay-at-home mom, you understand the difference between how language can label us and limit us in some ways. So we see Adam and Eve creating in there. God wants us to do that. But then the fall comes along, right? And isn't it great? Do you know how much the first Mac cost? It was $1,000 with a third discount, which meant it was $666.66. Now, the legend is that Steve and Steve didn't know that. They didn't know that that was significant because they didn't really have any biblical knowledge. But I think it's fun that they chose the archetype of human fallenness to represent hope and great products. So the fall comes along. And if you remember in the fall story, Adam and Eve run and hide. What's the very first thing they do after they run and hide? Right, they make something. So they use this creative power almost immediately. They recognize that God has put them in the world to make things, but they're immediately figuring out, how can I overcome some of the effects of the fall with what I can make? And God comes down, and we know this story so well. We know that he comes down and that he condemns the snake, and he curses the ground, and all these kinds of things. But for their act of making, he actually says, let me show you how to do it better, right? He gives them something better. And we know that this is an image of Jesus in the future. We know that they're trying to cover their own sin with their own works, and he's saying something has to die and cover it. But I also think this is God saying that in this world of fallenness and decay and destruction, we're going to need to make things that help us overcome the fall. They won't ultimately overcome it. They won't spiritually heal us, but these are good things for us to do. He doesn't condemn this. He actually shows them how to do it better. And we also see people like Cain who are, trying to make kind of an anti-garden. They're apart from God. And yet still this image of God flows. And we get music and agriculture and tools and all of this, even from fallen people in the Bible and still today. And even in a story like this that we usually tell kids because it has rainbows and all this kind of stuff, think about the God who is doing this, who is doing working with Noah. This is the God who can levitate people. He could have just struck with lightning all the people he wanted to die and left them. But he makes human making a part of the story of God. Again, this is a forward-looking portrait of Jesus, right? It's a righteous man on an object of wood over death and destruction, saving the human race, but ultimately failing. But yet, I think this is God again saying, the things that you make, I care so much about that I'm going to bake them into the story of God's redemption. And then Jesus himself. There's a Greek word that's used to describe Jesus a couple times. It's tekton. It's the Greek word from which we get our own word technology. Does anybody know how we translate that word? Any Greek scholars here? It's a title for Jesus. Okay, I'll give you a hint. It literally means an artisan or a craftsperson, someone who makes something with their hands. Carpenter, right? So according to church history, we think that Jesus was a carpenter. We're not absolutely sure because the word is just tekton. It just meant that he was a maker and a creator. So in some sense, he's fulfilling what Adam was supposed to do in his righteousness, but he's also fulfilling what Adam's supposed to do in his creativity. And the irony is that the Son of God in eternity past, he made all of us, but his creation turned on him and killed him, right? And then as a Son of Man, he worked with wood and nails, and then the technology with which he worked is a technology on which he ultimately dies, right? So God could have killed Jesus by any number of other ways. He could have died for us in any other kind of way. He could have been strangled or thrown off a cliff or buried or any of those kinds of things. But I think God's, for some reason, makes human creativity a part of the story of God here. And ultimately, he takes something that we took a tree and we twisted it into destruction, and he untwists it into a symbol of new life for us. Because I think he cares about what we're doing and what we're making. And even the end of the story doesn't portray us going back to the garden or up into a cloud. It portrays God taking all the things that humans have made and roads and trumpets and banners and somehow converting them and bringing them down to a redeemed earth so that some of the things that we do today, we're still going to be doing in heaven. I don't know what all that will look like. I don't know how literally to take this, but I know that Jesus needs a throne and somebody's got to make it. And somebody's got to wear to repair the bottom of it, right? Because he's going to be on it for a long time. So we're going to be making and using and doing these things in the future. So God doesn't care so much about destroying our technology, but of converting it into human flourishing. And I think this gives us a lot of freedom to do some things. I think one of these is it gives us the freedom to reclaim creativity and to be able to use technology together with our kids. So sometimes it seems like that's something like a concession that we have to do, something that we don't really want to do. I think this is something that God does want us to do. I think it also allows us to have boredom be a big thing and then to understand screen time in a little bit better way. And here's what I mean by this. You know, with my own kids, I try to, use maybe even play a little bit of video games with them. We don't play a lot, but we try to do things that we can do together and use that so they can be seeing and training and using that. We try to watch shows together and do a lot of things together in this young age when they're, you know, 6 and 8 and aren't quite able to use the device by themselves. The other thing we try to do, though, is when we say no, and they say, well, what should I do? I say, well, you go figure it out. So sometimes I want to present to them alternative things for them to do. But at the same time, every single study in the history of the world would say that you're most creative when you're most bored, right? It's that time when you're not in line, and when you're in line and you do this, right, that's when you're not creative. When you're in line and you're standing there, or when you're in the shower, that's when your best ideas come to you, right? When you're absolutely free and totally bored. So having limits actually helps us. And we see this in the creation story. You know how those first 3 days of creation and the last 3 days of creation, God builds little boxes for himself in the first 3 days, and then he fills them in the second 3 days, right? So in the first one, he makes light, and in the fourth one, he fills it with the sun, moon, and stars. I think he's agreeing with me, I hope. And then the second day he makes the land above and the land below, and then he fills them with fish and with birds. So he's giving himself limits and then working within those things. And I think that's a lovely deal. So one of the greatest gifts you can give your kids is boredom, is allowing them to say, go back and figure something out. That's when they'll come up with their best songs. That's when they'll build the best Lego structures. That's when they'll do all of those things. And also to think about, if you're thinking about screen time, I've seen some recent studies that would say for high school kids, you know, up to an hour and a half is probably okay. Now, that seems like a lot to me. But when people actually do a lot of studies on, you know, how does this affect someone's, you know, depression, thought process, all of those things, they would say, you know, an hour and a half or more, or an hour and a half is probably, you know, right around the limit. But that's not so bad for that. What I try to do with my own kids, though, is not just think about the number of pure hours, but think about the nature of those hours. So one of the things I talk to them about is the difference between if they're creating something versus consuming something. So, you know, my daughter will say, hey, can I come use the iPad? And I'm like, well, we already watched a show. How about you do something like a painting thing on there? And she's like, I don't really want to do that. I just want to watch a show. And she runs off, you know, because I've made this distinction between actually spending time with creativity versus with consumption. And also, you know, when we read our Bible on our phone, we're consuming, right? But we also want to make this distinction between what kind of thing are we consuming? Are we watching, you know, Planet Earth, or are we watching Troll Hunters, which is a great show, by the way? We want to make this distinction, and not to say that there's anything wrong with entertainment, that this is a good thing, but to be thinking about that balance there. And then also how we're using the screen. Are we using it with somebody in some kind of communal group sense, or are we using it just by ourselves in a corner? Thinking through these things and giving your kids these kinds of categories to think through can help us a little bit more with just the sheer number of screen time, because, you know, someone may need to do an assignment or something like that, and this can follow a lot of, it can be a creation enrichment an individual, it can be all those things by doing that. So I think giving some good terms can be helpful to our kids. Another important thing to remember is that whenever we use technology, it's always going to shape us in some way. Here's what I mean by this. Most of us, if you said, is technology good, bad, or neutral, how would you answer? Yes? Good, bad, or neutral?
Neutral.
Right? Okay. So most of us would use the term neutral, right? So we would say, here's a shovel. The shovel's neutral. Right? It doesn't have a moral value in and of itself. You can use it for good things, you can use it for bad things. It can be used either way, but the device itself is not actually good or bad inherently. Okay? What I want to show you is why I don't think this is a particularly useful way to talk. Okay? So I tricked you by saying good, bad, or neutral. I would say it's really none of those things. Here's what I mean. So when we use technology, we literally change the world when we use it. Right? So we do something with it. But if you were to dig with a shovel all day, what happens to your hands? You get calluses, right? And if you would keep using it, you know, the blisters turn into calluses. So here's my little PowerPoint effect. See, that's, there you go. And then maybe you get bigger muscles over time if you do a lot of that. Now, here's the question. Depending on what you do, if you're using a shovel all day, if you are building a church or axe murdering, either one of these things, Does the choice between axe murdering and building a church, does that affect whether or not you get blisters? So it has no relevance whatsoever. Okay, this is what I think that a very, very important point is this, is that we can use technology for good or for bad, but whether we're using it for good or for bad, it's not fully neutral, because when we use it, it still is going to shape us in some way. And so those are the kinds of things we need to be thinking about, is how it shapes us, whether we're using it for good or for bad. Now, we know this intuitively with our bodies, right? With this, even when we go into the gym, we choose machines based on how we want those machines to shape us, right? And we know that different kinds of machines will shape us in different directions. So if you become a championship power cleaner, you're probably not also a long-distance runner. And if you're a long-distance runner, you're probably not a championship, you know, leg lifter or something like that. We know that sometimes they shape us in different and mutually exclusive directions. So this is just something we know all the time. We know that if we go to McDonald's, that will shape us in one direction, right? And we know that if we get a salad, that will shape us in another direction. We know this intuitively about our bodies. But when we think about other things that we do, for example, here are some of the greatest books ever written, including the Bible. And I wrote a little program to figure out how many words they are, 1.8 million. And then I thought about using social media. And if I just checked it a couple times a day, just breakfast, lunch, and dinner, no big deal. I don't have that many friends. They don't write that much. And I do it every day. How many words do you think that is? I know. You all know it's a trick question. It's more words in the books, right? So why is it that all of us in this room, kids, adults, can do the activity on the right but not the one on the left? What's that?
Left requires
sustained concentration. Okay. What's that?
Time commitment.
But it's the same number of words, right? What's that? So the right side's about us. That's a good another one. Yeah.
Have to think.
Okay. Level of interest. Okay. You guys aren't interested in the Bible? Who are you? Just kidding. What's that?
Yeah.
You might better do both. Some people can, yeah. The catch is that these are two really different kinds of activities, right? So when you're on something like social media, most of the time you're kind of scanning, right? You're not actually literally reading every word in a sequential way. So you're doing a very different kind of reading. As a web developer, we know that when people look at a page, they look at it kind of like a capital F, where they look at kind of a big long strip across the top, then they look at a little bit, and then they kind of dribble down the bottom. That's how people look at web pages. So we don't look linearly at a screen. You know when you're looking at your screen and there's like a file menu and all these different things that you're skipping and the back button and all that on the browser? We're training ourselves to skip all kinds of things to get to something that we like. So the activity on the right is something where it's a very much of a scan mode. It's pulling in lots of different bits of information and assimilating it all together. Whereas the one on the other side is a kind of a logical, linear, different kind of activity. Now, some people can do both, but most people find that this is kind of like leg lifting and marathon running. They're two different mental activities that it's hard to maintain skills at both. Some people can do it. Our friend in the back maybe can, but a lot of other people would say that they can't. They're two different kinds of skills. So one of the questions to ask is, what kind of mind do I want to develop? The other thing is, just like working out or running, whatever we do repetitively, we get really, really good at. And if I think about social media, so this is Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, what am I getting good at doing? What's the question that it's asking me there? What's that? Yeah, what are you thinking about, right? So it's reflecting upon yourself. So this is the constant activity that's asking you to do is to think about yourself, your feeling, what's on your mind, what are you doing, what's happening, all of that kind of thing. And eventually you get really, really good at that. Well, what happens to someone who's really, really good about thinking about themselves? What's that called? Narcissism, right? So Facebook does not make you narcissistic in any way. It is not responsible for that. But what it does do is if you do this repeatedly, you just get good at the activity, just like you get good at running or any other kind of activity. You maybe don't want to always think about using Facebook in a way that's going to get you really good about thinking about yourself. But this is true that happens to some of us. And with all technology, every technology is in some way an extension of who we are, right? So a telescope extends our eyes. This microphone is extending my voice right now. A car extends our legs, all those kinds of things. But at the same time, whatever is an extension of our humanity can also be an amputation of that same thing. So I don't really have the ability to project my voice even to a small room like this because I've become dependent on microphones over time. And we see this with all kinds of things. I've been to Stonebriar before, but I still had to use my GPS this morning because I don't live here and I don't come here often. Once I've been somewhere one time with the GPS, I pretty much have to use GPS all the time. So we become dependent on that. And sometimes that's great. It allows us to do all kinds of great things when we can offload memory to a device. But probably most of us in this room, you know, knew lots of telephone numbers when we were kids, and now we probably don't, right? We've offloaded that. And that's great. We don't need to know those numbers. But there's other kinds of information we might want to know, right? Because when you look in the Bible, it doesn't actually tell you to read it very often. There's maybe like one or two passages that say, read this. And usually it's a prophet or something like that. What's the verb it usually tells you to do?
Meditate,
right? What do you have to do to meditate? What's that? Yeah, be still and be quiet. And you got to have it in your mind in the first place, right? You have to memorize. But once you've got it offloaded somewhere else, it becomes a lot harder to memorize. And so some of us find it harder to memorize now. So I say all this not again to be critical of technology, but to think about how would we shape our family life, our home life, in such a way that it would inculcate the kinds of behaviors that we want to do. So we might be thinking about our space. Where is the TV in the house? Where are the computers in the house? Almost everything would recommend never to allow a TV to be on in the background, that can be something that's very destructive to thinking or when someone's doing homework. We also want to think about where our kids use the device and where they're charged at night. So I usually use my phone as my alarm clock, but I've been finding increasingly that as I do that, the first thing I do when I wake up is I look at something on my phone, right? So I'm looking at it from the very beginning of the day to the very, very end of the day. So I'm actually looking into getting a new alarm clock just so that I can put my phone and charge it somewhere else. My wife started doing that recently, and she loves it. So thinking not only where they use, but where they charge. And what we're not trying to do is to say, again, that the device is bad itself, but to recognize the patterns that it has in it and where we would put it. And then we also want to think about how we structure the time that we have. So all of us probably have some type of practice, some place where we don't have devices or screens on. This might be a mealtime. This might be a significant period of the weekend. This might be, you know, after 10 o'clock, you say everything shuts down. For your family, you may have to figure out different ways to do that. And it may depend on your age. It may even depend on your profession. My wife is a university professor. And, you know, yesterday she had to grade papers on her computer all day. You know, she can't just not use her computer in front of the kids. That's not really a realistic option in today's world. But then that's going to mean that she's going to try to find some other time to have kind of a device or screen-free area. Because I know that our kids are watching us and they're observing the exceptions that we make for us because we're parents. And they're eventually going to want to make exceptions for themselves. That's only natural. And then I think the other part is just thinking about how are we going to find the activities that we do together? Can we do some with screens and some without screens? Again, almost, you know, 90% of parenting is showing up and being intentional and doing that with these devices as well. So a third one is this. Have any of you ever heard this phrase before? It was popular back in the 60s, you know, with Marshall McLuhan. The medium is the message. Here's what this means. Okay, if this is my first slide, would you believe what it said? No? How come? Why would you not believe it? What's that? Because it's misspelled? I heard that. What did I hear in the back?
Because the slide
sucks. Thank you, sir. And in what way does it suck? What's that? Color usage, right? So there's a bad contrast. It's hard to read. Misspelling, what else? Bad font choices. I used Comic Sans and Papyrus, the worst two fonts. Please don't ever use that. If you don't take anything else away, never use Papyrus or Comic Sans again. What's happening here is that there's a message that's in words, but there's another message that's encoded in the medium itself, right? And that medium is speaking to you more strongly than the message is. This is what it means by the medium is the message. The medium itself is communicating almost more powerfully than the words. Now, McLuhan meant a bunch of other things by that when he's talking about the nature of media and society, but this is at least one aspect of this, is that media has this incredible power of communicating itself. And in this case, the medium and the message are actually in conflict. Now, this sometimes happens when people talk, right? They say something that's not in concert with who they are, and we detect this, right? We can tell the difference when the medium, the person, is in conflict with the message. This is one of the great things about Jesus, right? Is that Jesus himself is the message. Right? He is God with us. It's not just that he spoke. It's not just that he did miracles. It's not just that he died and rose again. It's literally God with us. Jesus is the message. And we, the church, we are the message to the world, right? But when it just comes to personal communication, we tell our kids that 90% of communication is what? Nonverbal, right? It's all of these other things than just the words. All these other things influence whether or not this is an apology, whether or not this is a asking forgiveness, whether or not this is a mockery of someone. All of those things can be changed. The words themselves are important, but all these other things around it are what actually tells somebody what you're really saying. Now, when you switch this out from person to person to a phone, what happens? Some of the nonverbals go away, right? Some of these things, these change. And so you're left with something else. And so, you know, in the 1920s, when phones were coming online, there was this big debate about what should the decorum be. Because to call on somebody used to mean going to their house and leaving a note and saying, I'm going to come at 3 o'clock to talk about subject X. And then everybody gets all dressed up. And to call on is a very formal time. But now to call on is being in your underwear and talking about the weather. So conversation begins to change. And it brings with us some great things like speed and efficiency so that we can find out when we need to call 911, we get that speed and efficiency, and that's very, very helpful. But again, when we change media again, we sometimes have this potential now that we've lost tone of voice for there to be some confusion over what messages are actually being given, right? And there is this potential that the less and less of ourselves are there and more of the device is there, that we get some of these other things that can sometimes happen. Now, I know none of you have ever had someone misunderstand your text, right? Or your Facebook post, they didn't know what you were talking about. But we all know this happens. This is why, that the medium is the message that it communicates. And really, the authors of Scripture knew this. So this is a little passage in 2 John, where he's saying, the communication technology of my day, paper and ink, there's some things that that's good for. And face-to-face is good for other things. And in this case, he seems to be saying that if we didn't have paper and ink, we wouldn't have the scriptures, right? But at the same time, there's other things that he thinks face-to-face is better for. Now, Paul makes the opposite argument in Corinthians. He says, you know, I really wanted to come to you, but I was just so mad at you that I thought maybe writing a letter was better, more redemptive. And so he's sometimes saying that occasionally technology can be a better way of relating to somebody or through some kind of media. So knowing the difference between these two things is very, very important in thinking through what we're going to use. At the same time, there's been some interesting studies recently about how if two people are having a conversation and there's a phone out, if there's a kind of a just a conversation about nothing, sports, whatever, it doesn't seem to make any difference with people. But if they're having a conversation about something that's a little bit deeper, a little bit more serious about them, even if nobody answers it, even if the phone isn't either of the two people, just having a phone right there, that for some reason when people leave that conversation, they feel more anxious, they feel more ill at ease, they feel more depressed afterward. And the idea is that for some reason, this thing, even if there's no content on it, literally no message on it, that the medium becomes a message which says the world out there is more important than this conversation, that it always says that to people. So sometimes you'll hear people say, you know, at dinner you should put all your devices in the middle of the table, you know, something like that so nobody's using them. I really think that they should just be put away because the presence of them reminds us of something else out there. And so this is a completely secular author who's saying that we want to create a neutral environment, that we want to shape our spaces in such a way that it fosters closeness and connectedness and trust and perceptions of empathy. This sounds a lot like a church small group, doesn't it? But that even the phone itself, just being out, can communicate something to us. We want to be careful of that. The other thing that images that I want to talk about with media is if you think about a phrase like this, what it makes you feel, and then you change the media, and then you change it again, what you recognize is that when we say a picture's worth 1,000 words, it's really worth 1,000 emotions. Right? So this is the concept on which all advertising is built. You put an image that makes you feel something, and then you put a product right next to it, and then you want that product, right? And you come home with a big bag of something you don't need. That's how all of advertising works. Incidentally, this is also the way that pornography works, right? So we know that God made us to enjoy the opposite sex's form. That's something that he created us to do and to enjoy. But when we see images of naked people, what happens to us is not only the sexual desire, but also the emotional fulfillment that we get in looking at a picture. See how you felt first and then thought later when you saw those images? That's what's happening with pornography. So the reason why people start with pornography is that, you know, some kid shows it to them and they realize that they want to do it. But later on, the reason why they return to pornography is emotion and shame, is wanting to have something filled back up. So it's not just about the sexual desire, it's about the way that the image itself, not just the content, the way images themselves work upon the mind and the brain. This is why kids find it so hard and why adults, why probably half this room, finds it hard not to return time and time again because it's fulfilling an emotional need and the way that images work upon our minds. So you've seen all these terrible stats about kids and about pornography. So for us, what we want to do is to be able to have an action plan for it, to be able to think about using media wisely, and also our motivation. So here's the thing. This is what I've been telling my kids, is that they will see something bad on their computer. Sometime, they're going to do it. It's going to happen. It's not always going to be their fault. Sometimes it's going to be another kid. Sometimes it's just going to be something that comes up. That's going to happen. What we tell them to do is just to shut the device down, come and tell us, and nobody's in trouble. Just come tell us. If they see something they don't think they should have, no big deal. Just close it down and come tell me, and we'll work it out. And that way, we've developed a line of trust that's absolute and sure, that they're not in trouble, that they don't have to fold into shame. I remember when I saw the first thing that I shouldn't have seen on the computer, I didn't know who to talk to. It just wasn't something that we talked about. It was a hidden thing, and I didn't know where to go, and I had so much shame that I wanted to go back to it and all of those things. We want to keep this as open as possible. It's going to be out there. You're going to see it. It's just like going to the beach. There's going to be stuff you shouldn't see. Just look away and come tell mom and dad. And also to be thinking about with our own kids, how do we want to be communicated to? How do they want to be communicated to? Think about it like the love languages. What are their love language? Think about those kind of media. We all know how we want to be communicated to. We want to think about other people first, to be thinking generously toward them. And then also to think about everything about social media isn't just information, it's actually a performance. So when I say something funny on social media, it's so that people will think I'm funny. When I put something about cute kids on there, I want them to think I'm a great parent, right? When I go somewhere cool and take a picture of the food, it's because I want them to think that's what my life is like, right? No, not always, but it's part of that. And so when you're a kid, everybody, when they're a teenager, part of being a teenager is figuring out who you are and trying on different identities. And that's just part of growing up. You're going to try a lot of different things. But doing that online can be dangerous because it allows people to see a lot of those things while we're developing, and then that trail is still there. So if you think about every dumb thing you did in high school, you would not want it to be online, right? It'll come back to haunt us. And we want to protect our kids and help them understand why they don't want to put everything online. We also want to help them recognize, again, I normally wouldn't show a picture like this, but this is a young woman who had a great Instagram account. Billions of people liked it. And eventually she just went back through and said, none of this was real. All this clothing was given to me, and it would take me 100 shots and no breakfast, and I had to suck in my stomach, and I had to do this all day, and I hated every minute of it. But everybody thought my life was awesome, and so she shut her account down. You see this over and over again, people doing this, eventually realizing that it just doesn't work. So we want to have some realities with our kids. The first thing about social media you should know is that everyone can see everything you do. So there is no security, there is no privacy, it does not exist. No matter how much you think it does, it will be found out. So just assume that if you're going to put something up, everyone will see it. That goes for us too, even with our own children and our privacy settings. Everything you put up there, everyone can see. You should also know that as an advertiser, I can go into Facebook and I can say, people who go to Stonebriar, who drive Ford Explorers, who are over 45, who like black shirts, I can find all those things and I can target you for an advertising, right? Because Facebook's entire goal is to get you to come back and back and back so that advertisers like me will pay them to come back. So the whole goal is to get you to come back every single time. Every ounce of the way that they do it is to get you to come back. And to know, even among ourselves, even when we're trying to do the best, that our motives are always multiple. All of us are going to have mixed motives whenever we do something online. We can check them over and over again, but we're always going to have mixed ones. And then just to think about what's going to happen on the other end when we post something. I'm sure all of us have posted something we regret. This is why, you know, it's just worth saying, if there's anything that you feel might be remotely controversial, just at all, just wait a little bit. You can write it up. Type the whole thing out, get the picture ready, but just give it a 15-minute break and come back to it. I know I've had to do this before. We had a neighborhood issue on the message board the other day, and my wife sent me a message. She goes, this is what I want to post, and it was this long thing. And I was like, I'm sorry, I know this is going to sound mean on a text, but please do not do that. Just don't do it. And she actually called the lady, and everything worked out. So sometimes we just need to wait. At the same time, I think for us with our kids, creating moments that are media-free, and what I mean by media-free is not just that we're not watching television. What I mean is a moment that doesn't get recorded. So my own kids have started occasionally asking us, you know, like we think something they're doing is cute and we want to take a picture of it. And they're like, Dad, can you just not take a picture of us, you know? Because they're watching us, and what I'm communicating to them is that something isn't real and it's not valuable unless I've recorded it. So I'm training them in that by recording every single cute thing that they do. So by the time they get to be teenagers, they're like, yeah, real life has to be recorded. So what we're trying to figure out is how do we do things where, as much as I want to have every memory of my little babies, that we have times where we just don't take any pictures, don't do anything. And we just tell everybody, let's just put them away. Let's have a night that we can only remember in our mind. So the final thing I want us to remember is this. As much as we like to blame technology, and as true as it has problems, that it's not the root cause of it. Remember this idea about technology being an extension of humanity? Well, if you think about our natural ability to talk to people and how technology extends that, remember when Jesus says, whatever comes out of the mouth, where does it come from, ultimately? It comes from the heart. So he's not saying that it's technology's fault when we do something dumb. He's saying that really, underneath the hood, it's this broken heart here. This is the root issue. And I think this helps us understand how technology can actually work, and this, that technology doesn't force you to do anything. However, it does open up new possibilities. It does afford things that weren't there before, right? And this is what I mean by this. If you struggle with gambling, if that's just a thing that for some reason has hooked you, if you're over at Target, it's probably not that big of a deal, right? Unless you get kombucha or something weird that's kind of a gamble. But it's not going to be a big deal in terms of money. But if you're at a casino, the casino affords the possibility for you to act out in that way. So depending on where you are, that will open those things up. And if we think about the same thing with alcohol, depending on where you are, that struggle can be actuated in that way. And this is where technology comes in, is that technology doesn't make you do anything, but it affords things that weren't possible before. What's possible now wasn't when we were kids, was it? And the same thing, we all struggle with self-focus to some degree. This is what Paul meant by the term the flesh. It's an indirected pointing to ourselves. So when we're active doing something, serving God, that's great. But when we're on social media, it's always going to afford and actuate those things. So again, technology doesn't make us do anything, but it does afford those things. And if we think about simple technology like a microphone, it extends just one part of us. But our modern devices extend so many parts of us that they get so deeply entwined into who we are that it becomes hard to even imagine a life without them. This is why we are so tied to them and why we need to have places where we put them away. And again, as much as I like to think that technology isn't that new, when I think about where things were, where difficult things were, they're coming closer and closer, aren't they? And so these things that challenge us, they're closer at every moment, and yet we can't undo this world. So I think parenting is harder today, but to recognize that these are part of the reality. So for us, I think what we want to do is to continue to think about, how do I address my kid's heart? This is the thing that I can't talk about in a secular audience, because I can't really say to them that there is an immaterial self. But for us, I think for us to create these kinds of virtuous souls, we want to be giving them opportunities to serve, to be generous, to look for other people, to do something outside of themselves that doesn't get recorded, to go and give somebody, a homeless person, soup and not take a selfie while you're doing it, right? To do these kinds of activities. In the same time, to look out for narcissism, body image issues, defensiveness and hiding, to be looking out for those kinds of things in our kid. Because if they're there, it probably means something deeper is going on that we need to be discovering and pushing into. At the same time, for us to remember the gospel, that this is not primarily about creating, sober virgins. This is about creating people that are sold out, following Jesus and receiving his redemption. They can't do it on their own, and neither can we. They can only do this by the power of the Spirit, and this is what we want to give them, the grace when they fail, but also to recognize where their real source of power comes from. So again, we want to be developing character. We want to help them with their decision-making. We want to do some protecting and limiting, and this is what we'll talk about, these two things, just to kind of end up, and then we can ask some questions. On the protecting and limiting, almost all the things that we see out there would say that if you have young kids, they shouldn't be seeing screens at all. So your baby can read, don't buy it. Baby Genius, don't buy it. None of those things. They're all fake, they don't help you, and they destroy your kids' minds. Do not do it, okay? The APA has recently changed and said maybe at 18 months you can do a little bit of something with them. If you can avoid it, I would say do. It is the best and easiest babysitter in the world, but almost every doctor would say that it is destructive to a kid's mind. And while they're young, you have the ability to choose shows. You know, I see some parents who just kind of hand them the Netflix thing and let them watch whatever they want. I think it's still your responsibility to be shaping the content that they get and the media through which they get that and the books that they get. It takes a lot of time. It's hard to do, but I think it'll be helpful to them in the end. And then with all kids, I think as they get into their teenage years, I think you want to create the social media accounts with them. You want to have the password. You want to be able to get into that. And you may find that there's ways to stage that out. You may say that for the first little bit, that every time they want to post, they come through you and you post it for them. You do that for a while, and then you let them do it, but you still have access. You may figure out what works with your kid over time. But I think it's really important not to leave kids alone with internet-connected devices. And for us, this isn't so hard in our home. This is hard at other people's homes, right? So we have to ask that awkward question. Do your kids have devices that they can use by themselves? And we're those parents. And I'm happy to be that parent. I just don't want my kid to be, around some other kid. Because we've already seen it with a lot of words and things that they look at and talk about. So if you're going to send your kid over to somebody's house, you want to ask them about that. So for your own home, there's a million devices out there. You can Google them, home things. You can put it on your router, on your on all kinds of things. And you can also put it on the phone so you can give them things where they can't install. I'll show you some links about how you can do that. But I think this is something that you do early on where you're able to make it so that they can't install apps on the phone that only you can. And that you do that with them each time. So this may be something that you get to a point, maybe at 14, 15, 16, where you allow someone to have a little bit more freedom. But I think early on, if you're going to give a kid a device, you want to make sure that they're in some kind of public space, and you want to make sure that you're the one who's controlling what's on there and what's accessible. Then on the training and mentoring, I think with each of these things, you want to have discussed what it is, and then to have a plan for what you're going to do. So when you see the kid get bullied online or in person, who you're going to go to. When you see pornography for the first time, what are you going to do? Are you going to close the device, come talk to me? You're not in trouble. This is just part of the world, son. This is just part of the world, sweetheart. You're going to see it. Come and talk to me. also to talk repeatedly about what they disclose online, what they say about themselves. So I'm not one that's a real big fearmonger on if you post a location that there's going to be immediately 100 rapists are going to show up. I don't think it's quite that bad out there. But I do think that when we release information about ourselves, I think that kids just can't see the whole world. They just can't understand what all is out there, and that's okay. But helping them understand that the more they put out there, everybody can see it. Even if they've got all the safety they think turned on, everyone can see it. So I appreciate some things. What Lego's done recently with their social network is that you can't put any pictures of yourself on it. You can't use your real name. You can still put your creations on there. You can still share with each other. But they've basically figured out all the different ways of not just having that box that you check, like I am a parent, which everybody can just fake through. They also have a whole other set of security things in there. And I really appreciate their effort at going for that. And then again, modeling and mentoring. I know that if a kid always sees you looking at a screen before they see your eyeballs, they're going to remember that. And they're going to know that that's okay, even if you say it's not, that that's okay to do. You'll see that there are a lot of great resources for contracts. My kids are 6 and 8, so we're not quite there yet where we really want to sit down and write something. But there's so many of these things out there now. If you want to search for just about any kind of great contract, it gives you just some guidelines to look through, to talk. You can cross some things out, add some things, work on it together, and just review it every 6 months. It just gives you something in paper, something to look at that's permanent that you can come back to. Because remember, just like conversations about sex, this is not a one-time thing. This is a continual ongoing process. And I think, to remember, your kids are going to whine and complain, but they want boundaries, right? We all want them. We want someone to care about us and to talk to them, talk to us about them. Ultimately, this is something that I think they'll thank you for. So here's some of the best ones. How many of you have used any of these sites before? Used a couple of them? Just a couple hands. Okay. Yeah, so Common Sense Media is great, when you have younger kids, just to be able to look up, is this movie appropriate? What Harry Potter book can I read versus which show can I watch, depending on that? The Internet Safety Cheat Sheet, you got to put in your email, but they give you just some great little instructions on what you can do in your home. It's really nice. Again, Connect Safely has some great stuff for apps. And I think Protect Young Minds has some really great information on, again, just thinking through a plan. I don't think it's rocket science to talk to them about what pornography is and then to close it and come talk to you. But again, they have some other helpful things. And then here's a couple of books. Andy Crouch used to be the editor for Christianity Today. He is just a fantastic guy. And I think his new book, The TechWise Family, that really comes out this week, is probably the best thing you could get. It's really, really good about having really practical things, but also just some big picture ideas of the virtue of your kids, of what kind of family you want to be. He's just a great, fun writer, has lots of great stats. That one at the beginning about what parents worry about, that comes from Andy's book. And then Gary Chapman, the 5 Love Languages guy, has Growing Up Social, which he also has a set of, I think, 7 different things that he wants as relational values that he wants you to help you to do with your kids. And then finally, American Girls. This is definitely a fully R-rated book. This is not something you want your kids to read in any way. But just to get a sense of the reality, if you're at all kind of like, maybe it's not that bad, that book will definitely disavow you of that. And she has Nancy Jo Sales has a great article in Time Magazine. If you just search for her name in Time Magazine, you'll find it. And it goes through some of that.